Is Dinotopia still going?
I mean, James Gurney is still going. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's still expanding the universe. The last one, Journey to Chandara, was in 2004.
He talks about it pretty, like, he seemed post about it, but I don't know that there's, like, new content.
He's so prolific.
Oh, my gosh. And so sweet, and so, I think, especially, like, that generation of artists, it's amazing how giving and much of a teacher and a mentor he is, just for free, and because he wants to share and make people love art and do better at art. Yeah, it's, I think it is rare. I feel like a lot of artists of that time are more guarded, and you know, it's all about secrets, and I'm not going to give my secrets. And the new generation's not like that at all. Everyone shares everything.
Yeah.
And that's why I think people get, like, there's just like so many 14-year-olds out there that are like ready to work, you know, because they're just, they have access to so much.
I follow so many teenagers who are just,
I know, it kills me every time I go and I like look at someone's like blurb on Twitter, and they always, why do they always put like, I'm 14 and
14.
Oh wait,
senior applying to colleges, and you're like, oh my god,
like I could hire you now.
You think you'd be different? You grew up these days.
Yeah, I definitely think it would be a different thing because it was just much harder to get information. People would do tutorials occasionally. Mm-hmm. I think for me, DeviantArt was like through high school and stuff. That was a big source of learning, but it was mostly by just observing. There was a big culture. I don't know how much of that still exists, but there was definitely a big culture of, again, that sort of guarded, like, this is my thing and these are my secrets and this is how I paint and it's mine. So it was much harder to, I think, learn in that kind of environment, not, which isn't to say there weren't people that were really great and shared a lot, but I think, yeah, if you could go onto YouTube and, you know, watch prolific artists, you know, just show how they paint and, but, you know, get brushes for free that your favorite artists use and just have access. Like, you can just email or tweet at somebody and talk to people that I think, in, like, you know, for us, it wasn't as accessible.
Yeah.
I guess. So, yeah, I think that probably the, you know, the growth would have been a lot more dramatic. But I don't know. Who's to say?
We turned out okay.
We did. We turned out all right.
I'm already recording, so this is
good. You
just, just reminded me when we were kids, figuring out what we wanted to do. We loved Jurassic Park and loved dinosaurs so much. And the paleontologist advisor was Jack Horner, who's a famous paleontologist. And somehow I found his email online in the 90s and emailed him just asking, like, hey, how do I become a paleontologist?
Wow. Oh, I love that so much.
Emailed back.
Oh,
it was so nice. And then I saw what he said, like, I never want
to. They said you gotta be cool sitting outdoors and don't be afraid of rattlesnakes.
You have to get all these degrees.
Yeah. But still, I saved that email forever because it was so nice.
That's so cool.
That's awesome.
An accessible age.
Yeah. And so cool that you felt confident to reach out to him, too.
I would have never done that, like, 5 years later, probably.
Sure, yeah.
So self-conscious.
Yeah. Hard same with all my, when I was 14, I was just like, boop, ba-da, yep. I'm going to email everyone.
Yep.
I'm the best.
Yep.
I deserve this.
Yeah. All right. You both ready?
Yeah.
All right. This is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Ashley Swidowski and Claire Hummel. Ashley was a freelance concept artist before joining Naughty Dog to work on The Last of Us, Left Behind. And since then, she's worked on Uncharted 4, A Thief's End as lead character concept artist, as well as the upcoming Last of Us Part 2. Claire was an artist and associate production designer for Microsoft Studios, where she worked on a bunch of Kinect games, Fable Legends, Sunset Overdrive, Power Star Golf, and more. She was also the production designer for Westworld VR and currently works as the art director on In the Valley of Gods for Campo Santo. Thanks for coming on, you two.
Thank you for having us.
I'd have cut out a bunch of more credits for you, Claire, because there's so much
I think
stuff.
I should technically say In the Valley of Gods featured, like, presented by Valve at this point. Campo doesn't really exist anymore. It still exists as the owners of Firewatch, but
they've been, you guys have been pretty fully absorbed.
We fully absorbed into the Valve machine.
That's cool.
It's very surreal.
Do you know what the when the game comes out, what the Valve logo will be like, what part of the body will the Valve be on this time?
We've definitely already started planning that, which is way too soon in the process.
The important things. So, Ashley, how did you get into working in games?
For me, I think it started with kind of starting to immerse myself in the community online. At the time, it was conceptart.org was the forum where a lot of game artists hung out and socialized. And I had never really seen anything like that before, where there were a lot of industry pros that were on there and they were chatting with people that were students and, you know, coming up. And everybody had sketchbooks, you know, sketchbook threads that you'd post. So you get to see all, yeah, it was really embarrassing. And so this is really where I think I realized that this was something I could do for a living, seeing other artists making a living off of this and doing really well and seeming to enjoy themselves. It was stuff that I was really interested in, which was character and costume design. And at the time, I was actually going to school for 2D animation at the Art Institute of Pittsburgh. And I thought that I wanted to be an animator and work at Disney. Nobody told me that 2D was kind of going out of vogue and fashion. And I didn't really want to do 3D animation. It just wasn't something I was very passionate about. I wanted to draw. So I started to kind of skip class more and more and spend more time on conceptart.org and following artists like Wes Burt and Winona Nelson, who are so beautiful, such beautiful painters, and had such a way of portraying characters that I really wanted to kind of absorb some of that, and I wanted to be close to them. So I got the opportunity by applying and being accepted to what later became the Safe House Atelier. At that time, it was the conceptart.org Atelier, which wasn't as cool of a name. So I got accepted, went out, moved out to San Francisco, and started studying. We did a lot of traditional foundational work, and we'd sort of moonlight with concept art and learn how to paint digitally. That was really where I learned Photoshop. And after that, after I kind of wrapped up at the school, I started applying at jobs in the Bay Area. It was a lot of mobile at the time. And I don't think I was a very appealing candidate because I was drawing like very rendered, like grotesque monsters and things. And, you know, I just, it's such a different skill set to be able to draw. And, I don't want to say stylized as if, you know, this work I do isn't stylized. Everything's kind of stylized to an extent, but I just wasn't a fit for a lot of these studios. So I actually sort of gave up for a while, and I needed a job. I needed to live in San Francisco and pay rent. So I started working as a dog trainer at animal shelter. And I did that for about 3 years, knowing for years that I wanted to work at Naughty Dog, and kind of everything that I had done, moved out to San Francisco and studied under these artists I really admired, was all kind of with the goal of trying to get in and work on a Naughty Dog game. I applied, I think maybe twice in the time between when I actually got hired and when I was working as a dog trainer. And I wasn't producing the work they needed, or just didn't, you know, line up quite the way it needed to. But I kept trying, and I did dog training for about 3 years, and I was at the point where I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm just going to work with animals. And I was fine with that because it's always been one or the other for me. I love animals, and I've worked at zoos. I've, you know, done a lot of volunteer work in animal welfare. So I was like, I guess I'll just draw on the side and do animal training full time. But it's still kind of like I couldn't get rid of that feeling of wanting to create and be involved in media and games. So I kept trying at ND, and I decided, you know, I'm going to move down to LA. It seems like that's where the industry is going anyway. A lot of the games were the studios were relocating from the Bay Area. So I moved down on a whim. I got a interview with ND, and I did an art test, and it worked out, and I got in. So prior to that, I had done some, you know, freelance work on a couple mobile titles and things like that. But it's really my first industry gig, which was really intimidating. Not yeah. something I went in like, oh, yeah, I got this. You know,
especially the studio you have specifically set out
yeah,
to join.
Yeah, it really incredible. And also, I mean, like I said, this is a situation where I was willing to you know, work in animal welfare while I was trying for this. And it took years. It wasn't like I, you know, got it the first time or that I was sort of putting off other places or just like, I'm not going to work anywhere except Naughty Dog. I just loved animal training and figured I'll do this while I'm working on my portfolio and while I'm trying to get a job there. And it worked out for me. And when I got there, I was very nervous and very intimidated. But 5 years later, I'm still there and making games and still intimidated and scared most days, but a little more confident.
What do you think changed that got you in the last time besides the 2004? Was it just you improving as an artist?
I think so. I think it was improving as an artist. I think it was over the years meeting more artists that were there and more creators that were there and really understanding what they were looking for in potential hires. I think as a student, as somebody that's trying to get hired, everyone's always looking for someone to tell them what is the portfolio I need to get the job that I want. And everybody's very well-intentioned, but all artists have different stories and portfolios that got them different opportunities. So people would tell me you need to be very versatile and you need to have, you know, guns and characters and creatures and, you know, fine art and stylized art and all these things. And the reality of that is you just, you know, you're probably not going to be great at all of those things because they all take a level of dedication to be good at them. So you'd have these weak spots in your portfolio. It would be pretty glaring, you know, something terrible next to something really good. It makes you feel kind of like an inconsistent artist and maybe not reliable. So I struggled with that for a long time. And then as I met more artists, they helped me. And they're like, look, if you really want to work here, make your portfolio look like a game that we would make. Make your characters look like characters that we do. And I took that advice. And I think that that's when they started to be able to see me there because my portfolio looked like an Uncharted game or looked like a Last of Us game.
Yeah, they could just drop you in.
They could, yeah. So there wasn't any guesswork. They didn't have to go like, okay, so she can do this, but can she do this, you know? And of course, there was just a technical improvement too. I think, you know, I got better at painting and my characters became more expressive and I understood more what my role as a concept artist there would be, what I needed to provide. So I was able to communicate that more in my work.
Is that what Naughty Dog is looking for now still?
Yeah, I think so. So I'm a hiring manager for the character concept team. So anytime I'm looking to bring people on, those are certainly things that I'm looking for. And our entire team's looking for. It's kind of a, you know, when we bring anybody on, it's a group decision. But yeah, we're looking for someone that, one, I think really understands the games that we make, and that's has to do with kind of timeline. So we work on contemporary games. So we'll get people that will apply, and they don't really want to do contemporary costuming. They don't want to. It doesn't make them happy.
And it's deceptively hard
It is hard. And
contemporary
and
stuff.
That's another, you know, if I interview someone or speak with somebody and they sort of make light of what we do, and I think it's innocent, but it shows that they really don't understand. They'll say things like, well, you know, I don't really like drawing pants all day or another pair of cargo pants or something like that. It really oversimplifies the challenges of having to costume contemporary characters. So, you know, I'm looking for somebody that's just in general passionate about costuming, that understands the world and the timelines and is going to bring a level of excitement and enthusiasm to that, as opposed to somebody that's going to feel bogged down by it and just wishing they were somewhere else working on Space Marines or, you know, something that they would find more exciting. So I think they should go do that instead of, you know, work with us. But yeah, definitely looking for, you know, a certain level of technical ability. You know, style is negotiable because of the pipelines that we have at work. It's more about being able to communicate ideas to the creative director, things that will inspire him and help him see his characters that, you know, he's trying to realize visually, and just being able to bring through strong narrative in these costumes. You know, it's not just about drawing a pretty picture. You really have to bring out the character, the narrative, you know, all of those things, and the gesture and the costume and the character themselves.
Is that something that both of you find people are surprised by? That's not just drawing pretty pictures. It's
very much so. I think a lot of young artists who want to become concept artists are very character focused. And so often they think about what looks cool or neat rather than communicating narrative through character, which is insanely hard, especially with contemporary. Contemporary both because it's a limited palette. Same with historical costuming. It's always you're working within a set of parameters. And also because people are so familiar with contemporary clothing that if something's off, it is so obvious. And this happens a lot with dressing any women in video games.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, oh, okay, those are pants from 15 years ago.
Yeah,
very obviously
yes.
So. But yeah, it's so difficult to get that through to people that you need to communicate the context of the world that someone's in, the purpose of the clothing they're wearing, if it's pajamas or militaristic, their personality, and while simultaneously making a striking visual statement all at once. And I think people tend to focus on the latter. Games are so obsessed with making something cool instead of realizing if you design it well, it will become iconic. Like so many iconic film costumes are, you would not question them on the street, but now Big Lebowski is like, oh, you absolutely associate those sweaters with a specific character, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
I went to the costume exhibit that was at the museum a few years ago. I don't know if you got a chance to go to that.
I think I did.
It was really amazing. And
oh, was it at LACMA?
It was at LACMA,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and there was a blurb. They had the Lebowski costume there, and she talked about how when she read this script, there was a line that jumped out at her, and it was that the dude was perpetually relaxed, and that helped shape his costume for her. And she actually went to, I think, secondhand shops in Venice and sourced the costuming from there. But stuff like that is amazing. This idea that, you know, a costumer just kind of takes a line or a sentiment, either from a script or the director, and then you're able to kind of create this iconic figure out of it, which is, like Claire said, something that happens after the fact. This is a problem that I think a lot of I run into, at least. And it's up front, everyone wants something iconic. So, like, please make it iconic. Please make it, you know, that happens after that. People decide if it's iconic. We don't get to decide. We just try to serve the story.
Yeah.
And then if it ends up being something that influences trends or, you know, is replicated or is very memorable, a number of things go into creating that, but it's not something that you can plan for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Try for it.
Does it happen often when we see like a one sentence description, like the perpetually relaxed thing, or a description from like a director, then that unlocks the entire costume for you or character? Or is it more like the sum of everything you learn about a character?
Oh man, I feel like it depends. I've definitely had times where I've just like one off got it in one with a character's costume. But a lot of times it's a lot more exploratory to kind of feel it out. I definitely feel like I really value sort of abstract personality prompts for characters, because design characters, I like to think of they're like dogs. You can have really shitty, aggressive, tiny dogs and really nice big ones. And I feel like it's so easy to fall into those archetypes that you see over and over again. If you're just like, he's a big burly brawler, and this is, you immediately picture something. So it's so fun when we get a prompt for a character that's just like, this is their personality. This is how they treat other people. This is how people react to them. And of course we have some amount of backstory behind that, but it's really fun to run with that and see what comes to mind in terms of costume and character design. It's extremely fun.
It's a lot easier to avoid those falling into those pits of stereotypes, I think, if you get something, a moment in a story, if the director, creator can describe an interaction or how the character is reacting to a major event in the story, something like that, then I think you can start to explore broader ideas than if somebody approaches you and says, okay, we need the love interest, we need the brawler, we need, you know, that sort of thing. Could just pigeonhole you.
Yeah.
Claire, how did you break in?
I spent my entire childhood and early adulthood assuming I was going to get into animation. I had two kids. My dad was working in film and animation for my entire childhood. And so I grew up going to DreamWorks and Disney and just being like, this is it. This is exactly what I'm going to do. And then when I was at RISD, I interned at Turbine and I was like, this is a one-off thing. And then I got scooped up by Microsoft. They came to some portfolio reviews, some senior portfolio reviews, And they talked very fast. And I was like, Xbox, that's just Halo. I'm not interested in this. And my future boss, Ben, spoke very rapidly at me. He liked my portfolio. He handed me a controller to a console I didn't have and sort of shoved me out the door, and I didn't really question it. And then, lo and behold, they definitely made the most appealing offer. Like, trying to break into animation from the ground floor is so difficult and so trying. There's so many people who want to be there. So this was, like, right before the economy went bad. And so I, like, slipped into Microsoft and see, I thought I could do it for a couple years. And now I'm a decade later. I'm still doing it. Though I guess technically I never count this, but I spent 7 summers working for Neopets.
I have that written down.
Oh, God. And, but once I think back, I'm like, oh, that was working in a studio that made games. So that is technically how I got into games. What you said earlier about being a precocious young child who will send emails just out of the blue, that is pretty much what I did to Neopets. I was like, I like this. I can do better art than they can. I'm 14 years old. I'm going to email them. And so I sent them an email. I didn't know how to attach multiple images to emails, so I sent, I was like, there are 2 more emails forthcoming with my Neopets and NSYNC crossover art. And lo and behold, they thought they'd take a chance on me, and they were in Glendale, and I was in Northridge, so it seemed, so I could, like, commute with my dad every morning. And it turned out great, and worked there for 7 years, which is so pretty cool. So yeah, I think that is technically where I got my start. And then I just tripped and fumbled into video games and have been there for a decade. Which has been pretty cool.
So many of our artist friends are talking about how formative Neopets was to them. Why did it hit so hard?
I feel like a lot of people want to know why it hit so hard. I feel like, I mean, one, it was very much designed to be very addictive. but I think a huge part of the appeal was that it was quirky and funny. It wasn't patronizing to kids. Like, it didn't feel like a kid's website. All of the humor was very much our humor as the people making Neopets. And it was updated multiple times daily. So it was just this constant thing you could engage with at a time on the internet when that really didn't exist to the great degree it did with Neopets. But I mean, the reason I applied was because I was so obsessed with the site in 2001. Like, it had sucked me, and I loved my pets. It's like, everything I liked about Tamagotchis, which was owning a tiny pet with none of the actual, like, you don't really have to care for it at all. It just sits there sad and starving, but it's alive and I can dress it up. So that's fun. But yeah, I feel like the fact that it felt like it had this, not adult humor, but mature, funny humor and storylines. And it was, even though you had all these games you would play that were very blatantly sponsored by a variety of brands, you're still like, ah, I'm just doing that for the nail points.
I miss Neopets. I don't know what I was doing. I remember your art at the time, and I remember people being super into it. And I'm trying to think, like, where was I? Like, it was in, like, Dragon Ball Z chat rooms.
That's where we were.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Yeah.
Like, in GBZ pages for our characters on GeoCities.
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do you have any, like, of your old websites still up that you could, like, anything that's archived?
No.
I downloaded the one, like, AOL hometown website I had for Myst the Animated Series. Had made, like, character designs for an animated Myst series, and it was, they're very bad, but I made sure to save it all because it was precious to me.
That's cool, though. Yeah. That's so neat to have something from that time. I feel like I was so finicky online, and anytime I'd post something, I'd leave it up for a while, and then I'd delete it. Like, it was one of those. Like, you'd go to my gallery and be like, where did everything go? But yeah, I ended up getting rid of so much stuff, and now I kind of wish that I could, you know, but part of me is like, probably better that it's not still around, but also I kind of would love to go back and cringe and see how stupid I was.
So start for the basic question besides the intro stuff, and we've been talking for like half an hour already. Where do you start with when you're creating a character?
I think it's not super standardized, but, you know, for example, at work, usually I meet with the creative director and, you know, we'll sit down and talk about expectation, what's already been done, are there actors that are being considered? You know, again, if there's anything that's been written that gives me an idea of who this character is and what's their function in the story, what we need to accomplish visually. in the design, that's kind of where we start. And then from there, instead of diving in and just starting to explore sketches and things like that anymore, I'll do mood boards with photos. And again, because we're working in a contemporary setting, it's nice because I can go, I mean, this would be true for historical costuming too. Mm-hmm. You'd want to have photo reference and material reference and things that you could pitch. But usually I'll create mood boards and I'll try to group characters together as they relate to one another. And so I'll try to present, visuals in that way. And then from there, once we get kind of a loose approval on direction, then we'll start going in and concepting. And I found that is much more efficient than just sort of diving in and playing. That's fun mm-hmm. early on when we have time to do it. But once we start to kind of get enough information about the character, usually we're starting to be in production yeah. or, start to be more serious when we're sitting down and doing stuff. So, having enough of that research up front, I think, is essential before we're putting pen to paper, starting to paint and pitch ideas, because it's just wasted time otherwise. Like, we get to make cool stuff and have fun, explore and draw and paint, but it doesn't end up being very useful in pitching or presenting. So heavy research up front is always anymore where I start. My personal work, I think it's still important, and I find I learn a lot more if I do some research up front, but it's my character in my head yeah. as opposed to trying to dive into the creative director's head. I have to, it's a little bit more of a challenge because it's, they're not my ideas. They're not my, it's not my headspace. So trying to pull that stuff out of somebody else is more of a process.
I think a lot of young artists don't realize that so much concept work is in your head and not on paper. Mm-hmm. And so they don't count research time as character design, even though it absolutely is. Like, so often, once I'm finally putting pen to paper, I'm not like noodling it out on paper. I have a pretty good idea in my yep. head from research or whatever prompts I've gotten yep. of who that character is going to be. And I totally agree that you start off with whatever known quantities there are, whatever stakes you can put in the ground. And sometimes that's nothing. Sometimes it's a ton. Like, yeah, if they have a voice actor already, that's a huge direction to go with, where suddenly it's like, oh, I can listen to someone's voice while I'm working, kind yes. of play around with that. With the Lutece twins in BioShock, I had finished Young Elizabeth, and they were just like, hey, if you want to do these other two characters, they're just some scientists who designed the place. Don't worry about it. Maybe they can be redheads. And that was all I got. I had no idea what their role in the game was going to be. Oh, wow. So they showed up in the game. I was like, oh, there they are. Oh, there they are again. Oh, they're integral. I would have put way more thought into them if that was the case. But it was super fun with that, where I was just like, yep, want to make them look like a Gibson girl and an Arrow collar man from Linedecker. I'm just going to lean on that. And they seem to like it. With Zora, the companion character in the Valley of Gods, it was much more, we all kind of came up with this game idea together as a team. And so it was much more fluid and organic. And Sean had some vague ideas of how she wanted to come across, but a lot of her character direction came from my initial sketches for her. So it was a lot looser and more fluid to get to her character design. But yeah, so it's all over the place.
That's fun too, whenever you can explore a little bit and that ends up inspiring yeah. something that makes it in the end. I think that's maybe a more rare occurrence, but is a nice,
It
feels really good because, and to go back to this idea of what do people that aren't in the industry that are aspiring to be think concept art is versus, what it actually is. And I would say more often than not, you don't have a lot of creative control. You're often not being as influential as maybe people think you are. Your goal, your job is to, again, create the character that serves the story mm-hmm. that is being told. But it is kind of like a nice treat whenever something that you've snuck in there ends up being something that's really liked, or somebody doesn't notice, and so it just gets kind of shuffled on, and you're like, yeah.
Oh, that always feels good. My buddy Lissa, who's a head of story at Disney Animation, she'll sometimes like sneak character designs into her storyboards for background characters, and when they make it all the way through to the final film, it's so satisfying.
That's awesome.
Where do you usually go for research? besides Google?
I will say I'm a very adept Googler. I've started to realize over time that I was like, I don't know if it's because we grew up in the generation that had to learn how to use search engines, but I'm very good at using it to like bounce around from primary sources and find the words you need to find more words. But I have a pretty deep bookshelf of reference either for things I'm actively working on or things I'm passionate about. It's very gratifying to see that Guillermo del Toro keeps a huge library, and his point is always like, oh, I might not have read that book, but I might be working on a movie, and someday I'm going to be like, oh, I need a book about angels from this particular culture, and I have it right here, and it's accessible.
That's our excuse.
Yeah, so that's my excuse as well. So who doesn't love Egyptology? I feel like that's pretty universal. Kids love mummies. Mm-hmm. But as I grew up, it turned into this love of Egypt in the 1920s, the intersection of Egyptian national identity with archaeology and colonialism at the time. So I bought all these books about it, and then we were trying to come up with the idea for our game. It's like, yes, all of these books I have read or have been wanting to read are suddenly extremely relevant to my job, which is cool. Very cool. And libraries. Oh my God, libraries are amazing.
I have multiple questions. First one that's least important. How do you feel about the Brendan Fraser mummy movie?
Oh, I love it.
Okay, good.
It's near and dear to my heart. Oh, the new one is...
Oh, boy. We saw that with Ollie and Lily, and that's easily the worst Tom Cruise movie I've ever seen.
That's rough.
To backtrack to the previous question, how much background info about a character do you want from the writer or the creative director or whatever when you're starting out? Do you want, like, all of it, or is there a point where there's too much information?
I usually like a quick prompt, like if it's just like a couple sentences of like, this is where this person came from. This is a general age range, things like that. Too little is definitely frustrating, but so is too much. It can be exhausting when they clearly already know exactly what they want the character to look like, but they haven't given you any. They're like, no, just play with it. I was like, I know. You know exactly what you want. Just tell me and I'll draw it.
Yeah, I think for me as much information up front, but what that looks like ends up being, who are we casting? Who are we considering? What role do they play? Who are they playing off of? These things can be very, very helpful in the design process. And I don't think that there's really been a situation where we've been overloaded with information. Like, you know, here's everything. This is what it has to be. So we haven't really experienced that. I imagine that could, you know, be a little stifling and difficult to navigate. But I think because our character pipeline and production can be so extensive, we don't want to waste time. We don't want to start going off chasing things.
Absolutely,
that, you know, so it can be fun and you can go down. You could also get your heart broken that way because, again, somebody may have a better idea than they're letting on of what they want. And so you start to get married to things that they don't want and then you have to get reeled back in. So for me, I like with work, just let me know what you want. Give me as much information up front and we'll work on it. And it changes. It can still be molded and change form a bit. But yeah, I like a lot of information up front.
And how early do you want to be involved? Sounds like you want to be involved immediately so that the people already have an idea that they think of that they're not telling you. Like what you were describing before the youth character was?
Yeah, I feel like it's nice to be involved early because then it makes it more of a back and forth. It's not like you are given an assignment and you do the assignment. It's really fun when they can give you their rough sketch on paper of what they imagine for the character. And then you can toss them the reference boards and mood boards, as you were saying, some rough character sketches. And that way, either it's completely off, which is great, so you can reconfigure your expectations, or it leads them in a direction they weren't expecting, and they're like, oh no, I love this.
Yeah.
I drew one of our side characters for this game on a whiteboard, kind of as a joke.
Oh, nice.
And Sean's like, that's not what he looks like. And then it just sat there for so many months that he was like, well, now I can't picture anything else. It's like, ha-ha! I brute-forced my way into this character design. So.
What's the hardest part about designing a character for both of you?
I'm like, what did I write? Did I answer that one?
Is there anything that you dread?
Ooh. I can't think of anything that I dread, but I think I think one of the challenges can be differentiating how you're envisioning this character with the information you've been given mm-hmm. versus what the story needs and what the director has in mind. So I think that is challenging and getting too wrapped up in your own ideas and your own kind of maybe biases that kind of lead you in one direction. I feel lucky because at ND, it's a space where anybody from any department can have a voice. It doesn't mean that something's going to change, but you should feel confident that you can express an idea or a concern or anything like that. So I think that that's a great way for me to, you know, say, is this thing that I'm thinking of, like, is this going to work? Can this work or whatever? And you sort of have to talk through it, whether or not it will. But yeah, I think that just merging those two things, my expectation with what is actually what needs to happen, what the story needs, is probably the hardest thing for me.
Yeah, I think that's a big one, that you can get very attached to characters and concepts and just being mm-hmm. willing to throw them on the floor and move on just because they aren't innately a bad character design, you know, in a black void. But when you put them within the context, you suddenly realize, like, oh, no, they don't balance off of the other characters well. It doesn't fit the universe, what have you.
Yeah.
And from a technical standpoint, I definitely feel like just if you are really leaning into a character, like if you were involved with character for the entirety of a project, being able to draw characters super consistently is a hell of a thing. Mm-hmm. Like, this is my first time with Zora. It's probably the most I've ever drawn a character in my entire life. And doing expression and emotion sheets and just trying to make sure I get her from every angle. And then being involved in the process when it goes into 3D, where suddenly you realize all of your shortcuts that you take in 2D that look great.
Yeah.
And the moment you try to translate those face shapes into 3D, you have to work with someone who absolutely knows what they're doing. So having that language and ability to work with people up and down the pipeline to make sure that the character isn't like, oh, that the art book's gonna look great, but the final product is absolutely terrible.
And that's what you're there for. Like, I think, again, going back to this idea of what people think concept art is or wish it was versus what it is really, at the end of the day, it's about the project. And it's not about creating just this nice picture that exists in isolation and, you know, you did a good job, you're a great, you know, painter, whatever. It's really about seeing those ideas through to the very end. And a lot of time that doesn't involve painting.
It yeah.
involves conversations and reference gathering, shooting your own reference, you know, things that aren't as glamorous, but are probably more key in getting the final product where it needs to be at the end.
Absolutely. I feel like my best concept work is often just like a super rough paint over in Photoshop where
yes.
I just take a screenshot. I'm like, no, the yeah. rock should look yeah. like this.
You're like,
ooh. And it's like, this is the ugliest thing I've ever painted, but it communicates very beautifully
yep.
what my modeler needs to know.
Yep.
When you're working on a character for so long, like in the Valley of the Gods, do you ever get bored with it so much that you want to change it or alter it? Like, want to argue to change it?
We're improving it, I feel like, is the current state we're in. It's really nice to have joined Valve and suddenly have access to their full character animation and modeling team, because that's a skill set we had to work with contractors at Campo, because we just don't have it in-house. And so for us, it's more like, oh, we can finally refine Zora and make her look exactly how we wanted her to. But yeah, the longer you stare at something, you definitely see, you see all the weird flaws and all the mistakes in where things hit on the body or how a character is designed versus how they animate and how broken their rig is because you gave them huge hands or something. I love Dishonored. I do not know how they rig those characters. It looks like a nightmare.
How do you know when you're done? Is it just the deadline?
Deadlines are huge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you can...
Would you ever willingly walk away from something you're working on and saying it's done?
You have to at a certain point. Because at a certain point you die.
So yeah.
And you there's get a hard line in the sand.
You get frustrated and you want to move on. Like there is a point where it's just like, okay, I've done what I can with this, you know, moving on.
My cheat that I do is that I put whatever I'm working on. Oh, God. I make whatever I'm working on my screen, lock screen on my phone, which is really nice. So it forces me to just stare at it a ton in a context that's not my computer and not when I'm working on it, not when I'm expecting it. And so you'll often be like, oh, I need to fix that. Oh, I need to fix that. And at a certain point, you're like, oh, that looks kind of nice. And you're like, oh,
that's a good trick.
Almost done.
That's good.
It works really well. Yeah. So I put Zora on there as I was working on her.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That just stressed me out. Maybe away from work at some point.
He's like, oh no, you need to be working constantly.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting too, because I feel like I need to really step away from something. Because if I look at it long enough, I can excuse the things that are wrong with it. I can really like, you know, give myself a pass because I'm tired or I just want to be done with it or whatever. So I think, you know, shutting it down, turning off the computer and then coming in the next day allows me to kind of refresh and go like, okay, like, ooh, now I really see what's wrong with it, or, you know, so that I think that little break for me helps process information and kind of recalibrate a little bit. But I like that trick. I may try that.
Yeah, I definitely think it's enough to just like get fresh eyes on it and then step away. I think in terms of all the conversations around working in the industry right now, like that is a huge point that taking breaks is so valuable to the creative process.
Yeah.
Again, this idea that concept art is only when you literally have pen to paper or to Cintiq. So much of it is just like stepping away and having ideas or doing research and things that are not as tangible. Getting 8 hours of sleep every night. I've heard.
So even as writers, you feel guilty when I'm on the internet and it's like I'm working, but it doesn't look like I'm working.
Yes. Yeah.
Or even just like watching other stuff that's not your industry helps a lot with just working up ideas in your head and then being exposed to other stuff. Like that's working too, but it looks like you're having fun.
Yeah, that research element, or, you know, even if it's just like a creative break, like I just need to kind of focus on something that's a little different, but still is like related, I think is, it just gives your brain a little break. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you try to jump between like personal projects and your work? Just to switch your process?
I think personal projects are so important. And I wish that I had a little bit more energy to dedicate to them. I feel like I get so engrossed in work and I am in that headspace so much. But kind of going back to this idea of, you know, concept art is often balance or sort of surrendering what you want to what the project needs. I think that personal projects are a way to respond to that in a healthy way. you know, so you're not kind of banging your head against the wall at work or feeling stifled or like you're not able to voice what you need to. You can turn around and kind of inject that into the stories that you want to tell.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's incredibly important. I don't do it enough. I'm trying to paint more and be like, allow myself to just do like little vignette things, like not have to really dive into major story or, you know, complex characters. Just want to be able to paint quick snapshots in my head. And that's been very therapeutic for me lately. So I'm trying to do more of that.
Is that same for you, Claire?
Yeah, it's super valuable. Same boat of it's just hard to make time for it, especially when you are creatively exhausted. But it's so nice with personal projects. It is a set quantity. It has a finish line. You can show it to people, which is great.
Yep.
Like going from concept art, which as we said earlier, so much of it is rough and ugly.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of trying to get it out and communicate with people. It's very nice to sit down. And I've been doing a lot of poster design recently, and it's like, oh, this is going to be one finished thing.
Beautiful.
Limited colors. I can just hand it off to someone. And so when I'm in the right headspace and I'm getting enough sleep, it is very nice to do personal projects.
And it's, I mean, if you're on a project for as long as these things usually take to come out, when people finally see your work or you're allowed to share it, it's old at that point.
Yeah.
Like it's not even stuff often that you're happy to share with people. You know, when there's an art book, you're like, oh God, okay, I guess that has to go in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, and people are stoked because they like the franchise or they like your work. And, but yeah, I think for me anyway, I'm like, I did that 4 years ago. Exactly. Like, I'm not happy with the thing. But I think, again, it's that you got to compartmentalize it and say, this is work. This is just, you know, again, it's not like this piece that I'm supposed to hold up and be like, this is representatory of who I am as an artist and my talent. But it's, I think, having personal stuff for that reason is much better.
Yeah. How do you achieve good storytelling and character work through costumes effectively?
I mean, I think, again, it's going to sound redundant, but research is really, like, I can't stress enough how important that is. And I think that having as much of that up front and immersing yourself in that is key for me.
Yeah. My cheat that I put together for a class I was teaching once was treating it as a Venn diagram of, which we also kind of talked about earlier, but of function of the costume, which is literally what is its purpose in the world and for this character. Is a uniform? Are they going out? Is it religious robes? What is the culture they live in, etc. So function, personality, what is this actual person's reason for wearing it? How would they customize it? How would it fit? Little things like that. And then actual aesthetic of, oh, you want it to still be striking and appealing. And I feel like finding some balance between those three is a good way to, not that I like consciously think of this every time I sit down to draw a costume, but those are the abstract ideas that are going through my head of trying to figure out, like, oh, is this a hyper aesthetic thing? Is this like The Fall, the movie, where it's like, oh, it is entirely meant to look stylized and symbolic? Or is it super literal, like when you're doing contemporary clothing? And so finding the aesthetic punch for those is often way subtler, but can still be really good. Sure. And so, yeah, that's kind of, those are kind of the three things that I just keep circling in the back of my brain. And it seems to work pretty well for me. I always use a lot of Amidala's costumes in the prequels, especially episode one, where you see her at some political event where it's like, absolutely, she should be dressed the nines, symbolic, iconic. She's the queen of Naboo. It makes sense. But then you see her in a gown to go to bed and her hair's up and she has pearls, which seems so uncomfortable. And everything about her costumes is always designed to be like aesthetic to the nines with no accounting for the actual function of the costume within the universe, where it's like, oh, this is good fashion design.
Yeah.
But I don't know that it's good costume design.
I wonder if that's a symptom, too, of oftentimes women being much more a prop in a scene,
very much
or
so.
A part of the set dressing as a versus having their own story that they need to tell, or
allowing them to look comfortable
is
a huge challenge, which it really shouldn't be. But
I just watched The Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah.
I guess you've seen that.
I haven't watched it yet.
Won't spoil anything. There's some really beautiful costume design choices in there. One thing I didn't quite get was there'd be scenes where characters are waking up and they're in full makeup and, you know, they've got just, and it's not even really like the makeup's not meant to look like quote unquote natural. You know, and so you're looking at that and you're like, huh, what a strange choice. Like, I'm not sure, you know, and again, it could be very conscious. It could be a stylistic choice and something potentially that we're missing. But then for me, if that takes you out, then it's not doing what it needs to be doing. It's drawing attention away from the actress's performance or the mood of the scene and making you focus on something that's very irrelevant and very superficial. Mm-hmm. So I think that those sorts of things are really important. And I think especially when you're looking at women characters and stories, they're often not dressed for the occasion. They're not allowed to be comfortable or practical or functional. That's one thing I love about Naughty Dog Games is that we get to do that with our female characters, that, you know, they're meant to feel as practical and in it as their male counterparts.
Yeah, it really shows, I feel like. But yeah, it's interesting to realize that something that 50% of the population probably won't question.
Sure.
And then for us watching, it's like, yeah, when you see a woman wake up in full makeup, you're just like, come on.
Yeah. And like, it's weird because it is, most people probably don't notice it, but they are ingesting the information. It is going in to some extent and it's informing something for them.
Yeah.
And I think when we look at, like, we start talking about character design in a broader sense of what kind of ideas is it communicating about stereotypes or who people actually are as a group or individuals, that, you know, it perpetuates strange ideas that maybe on the surface don't seem very harmful, but are we still like locked in this idea that women wake up in like full makeup? Like,
You see a woman without makeup in a film, people are like, is she sick?
Is she dying?
It's like, no, it's just, I'm so sorry.
That's how true. It looks. It's really interesting too, navigating that, those expectations of the way people are portrayed in film. Oftentimes, even in a dystopian kind of setting, people can look a lot more beautiful or, you know, present a lot more beautifully than they may in an actual reality.
Yeah.
But it does start, as a designer, you run into those things. I know with The Last of Us, it's always kind of like a balancing act of how real can we push it before it's such a novel thing for players that they're now distracted by
it. Yeah, they're taken out of it.
So they're like, oh, yeah, that looks very natural and real, but I'm sort of bothered. But I'm like, I'm repulsed by, like, you know, and I can't, you know, stay into repulsed when you're not supposed to be. You know, probably don't want to.
Can you give an example of that from the past games?
Good examples. I think with Uncharted, it's interesting because Uncharted is meant to feel pretty glamorous, but you have people that are fist fighting and they're rock climbing and falling from ridiculous, you know. So there's all these things that by the end of it, you would expect Drake to be unrecognizable and
have huge
calluses. Couldn't even look at him because he's such a mess, you know. But we need to maintain a certain fantasy because that's what the story is. It's meant to feel lighter and fun and there may be stakes, but Nate's not going to die. You know, he's going to be okay in the end. He's got a cut on his head, but it's probably not as big or gushing as it should be.
That will look really cool.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's just at the right angle. So that sort of thing is always kind of like a tightrope.
Was there ever any concept art with Sully having like nicotine teeth and all the cigars he has?
That's always something that we really want to push. But again, that's like that is a thing where then you see the character in a scene and you're like, you know, it's like too.
And there's some things that you accept in film and in games. It's just so.
Yeah.
It stands out because teeth always stand out. So you do anything to them and people are just like, oh,
really,
oh no.
Yep. It's teeth. Yep. And there's a lot of things you want to do with.
Well, it's just like you said with the horses in Red Dead 2.
Yeah. Exactly. There's just that's always something that's very intriguing to push is more realism in that sense. I think also because film is older and more experimental.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you can watch a movie and see something really like gritty or visceral. And not be as pulled out of it as with something in a game where you're like, I've never really seen this before. It's so novel that I'm distracted.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just, or it's like, even when tech, like anytime we get new tech, like as an industry, like when like bump map became a thing, like everything was just, it was everywhere and so extreme. And then when like stitches became a thing, like just like big and, you know,
it's like you can't see seams on most clothing. Yeah, insistently jeans would have
exactly thick. Like look at that stitch tech. Aren't you impressed? Yeah, so oftentimes I think the industry gets excited about new tech and they want to show it off and show people like, look what we're doing, but it pulls you out because you don't see stitches like that unless it's like a very specific fashion-y brand of clothing
or Superman.
Yeah, exactly.
Slightly related, since what's technically possible in games is always changing, are you always trying to stay up to date on that stuff so that you know what you can do with your art? Like, you can make floppy shirts work now? Or is it more that you'll draw something and then get feedback on what is or isn't possible?
Oh, you have to. I mean, you can do the latter, but that kind of sucks for the people you're working with.
Yeah.
This was definitely a thing with Fable Legends when I designed a character with a huge, like, flowing thing. And I was like, okay, how can I shift everything so we can rig it to kind of attach to the legs a little more. I think being aware of those parameters is hugely important. And especially with our team is so small, so I do a lot of the texturing in Substance Painter and being very aware of a PBR pipeline and how that limits you and what other tools you have. And Zora's hair, also trying to make sure we can get that right. It is so important to be absolutely up to date with what you were able to do, because it affects so many aspects of the character. But at the same time, still allowing yourself to take a couple chances, to the point that if the team wants to try and figure out how to do floppy shirts, then they can.
Yeah. I think it's often like, you know, deadlines and like, what, you know, how much time do you have to test something, R&D something, but that's always a challenge too. And wanting to create immersive costuming and stuff that feels natural, games, because of technical limitations, have so often had to essentially skin the character in something, you know, and so you get these very tight fitting silhouettes. And so it's always sort of the same. Video game silhouettes are always sort of the same. And part of
jackets
that is,
always do that.
Yeah, where it's like very tailored and fitted. So I think that if you can push the tech a little bit and say, well, can we put them in boxier clothes? Because that really helps sell who this character is, or help sell the scene better. You know, and depending on the time and the energy level and how well you can pitch that.
And being aware if you, like, you might need to change it down the line.
Yeah.
But
totally. Yeah. Yeah. But I like pushing that stuff. And it's something that I look to other games constantly. I'm always playing everything and trying to watch as many new movies as I can too, just to see. Because we're not only trying to keep up with games, we're trying to emulate Big Brother.
Yeah.
Film games. And want to be film, so how can we be more like film?
How do you stay up to date? Just talking to team members, or do you go to like GDC talks about?
Yeah, going to GDC, trolling forums, going on ArtStation or ZBrush threads, ZBrush Central threads, and talking to folks at other studios, playing games, any of the above. Like that information is so accessible now, especially with stuff in the vault for GDC. It's so easy to just page through the past 5 years and see what people have been up to.
Yeah.
Like when we were doing hair, we're definitely like, oh, who else has done natural hair? Naughty Dog has. And even if you aren't using that technology, it's nice to see how people are breaking things down and how they're solving these problems. And especially with clothes, which are the last fucking frontier of video game character design. Like, it's so weird. I was thinking about this playing Red Dead last night, where these characters have this like beautiful, waxy, thoughtful skin with snow collecting on it. And then they just have these awkward big coats that don't fold properly. And so I'm so desperate for like really thoughtful fabric sims.
Oh, yeah.
To come into vogue.
Yeah, I would love it. I mean, and I don't know what it's going to take. I don't know what studios are really going to revolutionize that, but we need proper cloth sim. If you're out there, if you're a programmer and you want to, like,
even with things that are relatively fitted,
right,
like realizing how much folds change and affect with the slightest movement.
Yep.
And God bless people starting to use wrinkle maps to bring that back. Order 1886 did some really cool stuff with that.
That game's so beautiful.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
Got such a bad rap, but really, like, it's, sit down and play it in a manageable amount of time as an adult with a job. Like, it's gorgeous. Like, I still feel like it's one of the most,
I don't understand how they did some of that stuff visually.
Incredible. And so, like, I loved how tight everything was. It was like brick looked like brick and cement looked like cement. Like, there was so much consistency and cohesion and everything. I just thought that game was really incredible. It blew me away when it came out.
Yeah.
Really beautiful. And werewolves.
Yeah, hey.
What do you think has the best clothes tech?
That's interesting.
Has any impressed you? you should describe Ashley's face when she sighed right there.
I think a lot of studios do great things with what they have to work with. Again, I think it's an industry thing.
Yeah.
The industry is not really prioritizing it. And putting it kind of up on a pedestal. But as we, you know, devote more and more energy into using digital doubles and scanning things, you know, scanning real clothing, we're going to have to answer to that, because our faces are moving properly. And say us as an industry, our faces are moving properly, but our clothing is not. Like Claire said, it's stiff, or it's not believable, or it's clipping through everything.
Yeah.
So in terms of who's doing it best, I don't know. I think the Order, again, like I think the Order was able to design their costumes and they functioned in a world where they could do these things. But I want to give credit to the people that were able to group things, group shapes. And
yeah,
and
they were designed. So I think that's the thing. It's rarely like the tech is outstanding so much as they were super smart how they worked within those parameters.
Yeah.
And the few times that you do see a loose shirt, just having just enough wrinkle maps as he moves to shift the folds on the back is super satisfying and effective. And it gets you so much closer to the sort of photorealistic movement that you're looking for.
Definitely.
Claire, since you worked on Westworld, did working with VR change the way you did art at all?
Changed the way I do art while I was working in VR. it was very interesting because when I took that job at HBO as just a general interactive team, we didn't know what we were going to make. We got our hands on a DK1 and we were like, oh, this is amazing. It has no positional tracking, but I still thought it was amazing. and slowly but surely, we decided this is what we want to do. We were working on the Vive. And when you have to design for essentially like 90 frames per second per eye, so 180 frames per second, and suddenly normal maps don't work as well as they used to, like the eye can pick them out, it makes you design very differently. So we had to be much smarter in how we were designing things, how we were placing props. Also, with room scale VR, if you're only walking around a limited space, the fall off is so dramatic in terms of resolution of props and how much detail they need, because you don't get up close to them. And you realize that that screen door effect of like the actual pixels, you're like, oh, something's 30 feet away and it can be, you can shrink it down so dramatically. So it was very interesting to work within those new parameters. It was really fun also just to experience, you know, VR has a very different sense of place and existing within a world. And so experiencing that and then trying to kind of bring that feeling back to video games is really fun, because I grew up loving the Myst games and I still love the Myst games. And I think they're a very good example of like, oh, you are fully in that world. You feel like yourself. And so trying to recapture that with, you know, wandering around tombs in Egypt has been super fun.
And I don't know how you feel about Westworld, the show.
Oh, yeah.
But how was it working on a show that's so influenced by video games?
It was so surreal. It was the perfect fit. You know, of course, we were working on stuff beforehand. We're like, Game of Thrones, Boardwalk Empire, what can we do? What franchise can we work with? And then the rumor came down the pipe that Westworld was a thing. And it was so surreal because we'd work out of the Westworld writing offices in Burbank. And so we'd come down to pitch to Jonah and his team. And they would be talking about how their AI's malfunctioning. We're like, yes, so is ours. And so it's very interesting because they were smack dab in the middle of writing that first season. And lots of decisions hadn't been made about like, oh, can guests feel pain yet? Can they do this? And so it's very surreal to be, one, writing our experience simultaneously as they are writing the show, and also seeing the influences that they would have on each other, because it's such a gamey show. It's such a good fit for VR. Like the fact that it's just within the conceit of the universe that you have things like AI and things malfunctioning and going wrong, and that it just feels like a Western video game. I mean, it feels like a shitty Red Dead, essentially. and it was really fun because it gave us stuff to play around with. So the conceit of the experience we made was that you are a host who is programmed to be a guest. So you're like testing out the Westworld before it launches. And so you get shot in the head, you wake up in a diagnostic room and go through that whole process. So yeah, it was very surreal, but very cool. And I imagine that we had some amount of influence on the show itself, which was really neat to think, because they were intimately aware of how difficult it was to make this VR experience. So, yeah.
Ashley, you're a big fan of Resident Evil.
Yes.
I don't know if Claire is. You are too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then maybe you can both answer this. Yeah. What's so good about the character concept work of Isao Oishi?
So good.
But why?
I think that... I think for me, what really resonated about those designs were they were some of the first that felt human to me, and the characters were presented as, I mean, there are a lot of stylistic choices still and quirky things, but I think that there was just something very natural in the portrayal of the characters and the expressiveness of the illustrations. And yeah, it was very influential to me. I think seeing that stuff, I was like, yeah, I want to do this.
Yeah. Awesome.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. It's like, I see where that happens.
So like related to that with like people's inspirations and influences, like what are the three things that you think have had a major influence on the work you are doing now? Is Resident Evil one of them?
I think, Resident Evil is huge. Probably more than Resident Evil, even though that was one of the first, Resident Evil 2 was one of the first games that I played on my own the whole way through, Silent Hill has been massive. The concept art in that game and the portrayal of the characters, it still sticks with me. Like, I still go back and I look at Maria from Silent Hill 2, or I look at Heather from Silent Hill 3, and they feel so tangible to me. They're not without their problems, and we've come a long way in games. But I think that there's a level of nostalgia that I can't get past, so probably a lot of that coming through. But Silent Hill is incredible for me, and I'll still have something up from the game while I'm working at work, just something to kind of not even riff off of, but just get me excited about what I'm working on. Final Fantasy was a huge one. I think Nomura was very influential in those Final Fantasy VII characters and drawings, and they didn't influence me as much. It wasn't kind of the style that I wanted to go into. I'm sure there's a number of things I'm not thinking about, but definitely like the horror genre, games in the horror genre were always the things that were the most immersive to me. I never really played Myst, but I bet I would love it because what I loved so much about the horror genre was it was mostly about puzzling and kind of navigating the world more than it was about combat. The combat wasn't ever very great, and I didn't particularly like love going around and murdering, and so it was really just the kind of puzzling in the environment that was really attractive to me in that genre.
What about you, Claire?
I feel like for character design, it's hard for me to cite any video games because there are...
Doesn't have to be video games.
Yeah, I know. but it's sticking with just... I was just trying to think. I was like, what are my game influences? And I think one of the big ones is Riven. The second Myst game was a huge one for me. Because I was young and
are there characters in that game?
Yeah, but I mean from environment design.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because I have to design everything for the game we are making. But I think it was the first time I'd really been introduced to this idea of environmental storytelling, which is tossed around nowadays. But that game did such a good job of establishing an existing universe, a culture, this. Gen's influence on that culture and how he had broken and destroyed it. The fact that there was this language that you could understand and translate within the game that you would see. You could read journals and see evidence of all of these characters and their influences on the environment, even when the actual characters you see in the game they're like four actual ones that talk to you. And beyond that, you occasionally see villagers like running away from you and trying to avoid you. But it was the first time I had ever considered this idea of like, oh, you can do storytelling with environments with no dialogue, with no characters, that you would just have these established symbols of, oh, Gen is using the warg, this creature. He is bastardized it into the symbol of power, and you start to see that symbology in petroglyphs that the villagers have drawn, and he uses the skulls in his architecture, and it was just, and there's a children's toy in the, god damn it, there's a children's toy in the schoolhouse that's a counting toy, and you like spin it and it lands on a number, so this is how you learn numbers in the game. And the way it works is it's a little hangman being dropped into a warg's mouth, and that's the number of times it drops down. And I was like, that's brilliant that he's even influenced it down to like young children learning in the culture. And that was so influential to me, this idea that you could design environments that thoughtfully.
Yeah.
Super cool. Oh man.
Yeah, I love you've sold me one. I love stuff like that. Whether it's something you're playing or a film you're watching or a book you're reading, something that makes you sort of stop and pull away from it and be like, oh my god, that's brilliant.
Holy shit. Yeah.
Like that is brilliant. If I could ever do anything that's like even just a fraction of that, I will be content. But yeah, I've definitely had those moments with Silent Hill games where I've just kind of sat back and been like, that was so cool. That was really awesome.
I think they're kind of comparable in that horror games are also very much about like getting you fully immersed in that space.
Yeah.
Like when you play horror games, like I love horror movies, but they don't stick with me as much as games do. Like games will, even like BioShock would just follow me for months afterwards. It does such a good job of just completely losing you in those spaces.
What do you think that is? Do you think that's like that you're a part of it, that it's taking you through?
Yeah, you have some agency in it. So it's very personal. It's happening to you and not to a character on screen.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And you can't close your eyes and wait for the scary stuff to go away.
I know.
Still. I tried playing PT again the other day.
I've
played it before, yeah. And it's just so terrifying. Like I can't imagine what whatever that was going to be, whether it was anything like that or something.
We'll never know.
We'll never get to see that. But I'm excited for whoever does the next thing, like whoever takes the genre. Because I feel like the genre has stagnated a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think the coolest stuff has come out of indie titles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like Inside was so bizarre.
Did you play Soma?
I haven't played Soma.
Soma is so good.
It's good? Okay.
Those developers, I think, are the ones that are pushing for different things with horror.
That's cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I love when they're more experimental. There was a cool one that I played, Layers of Fear, I think it's called. Did you guys see that one? Some really neat like visual effects stuff that they did in that I haven't seen in any other game. It's just such a trip and so bizarre and really resonates.
I would just say that our influences from growing up for writing are just Batman the Animated Series, or strong economical storytelling that is deceptively simple, but like so well thought out. Calvin and Hobbes.
Mm. Oh, I mean, always.
Yeah.
I've been staring this whole time. Calvin
and Hobbes. To listeners, we have a Calvin and Hobbes wood print behind the table and Michael Crichton books.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That all tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I feel like characters, it's definitely a lot of games and film and animation.
Yeah.
And historical stuff, like as we were talking about, like engaging with media outside of video games, because it's a very incestuous industry when it comes to character design.
Yeah.
You can see it feeding off of each other. So yeah, when you're looking at modern fashion, when you're looking at historical illustrators, it's so good. That's why like Leyendecker and Gibson are constant influences. Oh, so good. And I feel like for animation, Prince of Egypt was super formative.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
My dad was working on it, so I spent a lot of time at the studio, like poring over those model sheets.
Yeah.
And they didn't really stick with it, but it was such a break from form for feature animation, where they're like, we're going to tell adult stories. Kids are still going to love it. We're going to stylize it in a way that's totally unique and doesn't feel like Disney. And that's definitely something. Oh, that animation sticks with me. It's so beautifully done.
Yeah, that was definitely. I mean, I know so many designers and developers who were influenced. And I think people still trying to recreate that experience. Yeah.
Set a high bar.
Mm-hmm.
If I could shout out a show I just watched right now that made me feel like the stuff I was watching as a kid, the Netflix show Hilda.
Oh my God, I haven't watched it yet. And I've heard so many good things.
It is incredible.
Oh, we're in a real renaissance of like TV serial animation now.
Yeah.
Kids are lucky.
Yeah.
I know. Stuff is so incredible. I haven't really like delved into Steven Universe, some of the other popular shows right now. But I'll see somebody's written an article or some people are talking about it on Twitter. And I'll go and I'll like watch that episode or something.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. This children's show is dealing with like just these really complex, like abusive relationships and how to navigate them and, you know, how to come out a stronger person. Like, what? Was there anything like that?
I know.
Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah, really. Like,
and the Brave Little Toaster.
Yeah, I mean, Disney, talking about influence, you know, I don't know many artists that aren't influenced by Disney
to
some extent. And, but I look back on like the storytelling and really like what messages were and stuff. And it just, a lot of it feels so contrived or just these regurgitated ye old morals and things that really aren't applicable to society anymore and wouldn't be worth telling stories about if it weren't cloaked in beautiful imagery and fun songs and things like that.
Lilo and Stitch. That's another one I will count as a point of reference.
I saw you talk about that in an interview. You were gushing about it. It was so good.
It's so good from a character design standpoint, from a narrative standpoint. Like, whenever people are like, oh, Frozen's the first Disney story about sisters. I was like, no. Lilo and Stitch is such a thoughtful, like, complex relationship between two sisters that fight and love each other. And it's about human stories told within a fantastical setting.
It's so good. It's about depression. Like, just.
And parental death. Yeah. And it's everything about it is so thoughtfully done. Yeah, and Chris Sanders' character designs are always just
really beautiful.
Again, when you let someone really, when you have a creative lead for a project that they were just like, ah, Chris and his dumb little project. He can go work on that. And it feels so cohesive because of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful game or a movie.
I have a question from an Ashley interview, but both of you can answer it. So in this previous interview, Ashley mentioned that creating characters that are lifelike and don't feel superficial is the hardest part of your job. So how do you successfully accomplish that?
Did I say earlier that something else was the hardest part of my job?
I can't remember.
Maybe I flip-flopped.
That's a good reason. This is like a year ago.
Especially changed. In games.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It really is. And in games that there are certain archetypes and certain characters we're used to seeing over and over again, I feel like as much as I love cosplay, it's gotten into games in a way where now a lot of designs are kind of, that's part of the thought process. Like, I think
we ran into that at Microsoft and it bummed me out. Yeah. Like, of course I want my designs to be cosplayable because I want them to be made well.
Of course.
But
yeah, it's
like,
just,
what does that mean? Like, what are you?
So it would just be something like, I mean, make sure it's something that people can essentially do and be recognized for. So it's, I think, again, this idea of making something iconic up front or whatever. It's just another version of that, I think, just kind of cloaked in cosplay. What I love about our games and the costuming that we do is people can mostly look in their closet and put something together very
and
quickly.
It still feels like, oh, if you see, if you see Nathan Drake or something, you know exactly who it is.
Yeah, so that's something I really, really like, that it, our stuff is very accessible for cosplayers, and despite your skill level or resources you have, you can probably put together an Ellie or a Drake or something pretty quickly. But yeah, avoiding something that feels superficial, I think, can be challenging, and especially with something contemporary, because you do have to put in a lot of thought about what is the narrative, where did these characters get this, what does it tell about the story, what does it tell about the where the character is in the story, who they are, avoiding stuff that's too on the nose, where you're sort of beating the player, the viewer over the head with something. All those things are kind of a juggling act. And it's a special challenge. It's a challenge I enjoy. It's not something that I avoid. I approach it with excitement, and I think it's a puzzle worth solving.
Yeah, I think actually I love talking about character design and concept art in general as a puzzle. Mm-hmm. Like, that is very much what it is. It is critical thinking. Mm-hmm. It is concept art. And so trying to solve that puzzle is very compelling, especially when you realize that everyone in the world, what they are wearing is every decision they've made in their life has led to them wearing this. And so when you're trying to make that, as you said, it can come across super superficial or heavy-handed. Yep. And so trying to get inside a character's head and make those decisions for them and be like, this is how they got it, this is why they're deciding to wear it, this is why they still have it, is, it's a lot.
I was talking to another concept artist the other day. I won't name the game or the character or anything, but we were talking about this sort of fantasy character and their design and the shoes that they wear and kind of like how it's this like complex like wraps and leathers and like things that don't seem to attach. And it's like that character presumably gets up every morning and spends like 3 hours wrapping their foot and attaching this, leather belt that doesn't seem to hold up anything and, all that sort of stuff. And going back to something Claire said with something like the fall or the cell, that are these like very visual, kind of extravagant
I like everything Aiko Ishioka does. It's those like over the top symbolic. You feel like you're in a Catholic church.
Exactly. And yeah, it feels like a painting. It feels like every frame is a beautifully composed painting with these like beautiful colors and just all these different materials and different things. But often, I mean, unless that's explicitly what you're going for, I think it can really bog down a story and make stuff feel silly. And I play so many games where you have like the hacker character and they've got like all this stuff. And then they're in this scene where you like learn something about them and like their tough like upbringing or whatever. And it's like, I'm sorry, I can't pay attention to you because you've got like a neon thing on your head. And like, you know, it was so important for whatever reason, whoever made those decisions. By the way, like games are such a collaborative process. It's not like any one person is responsible for any one thing. But, you know, the decision to go in that direction really kind of sacrificed mood and tone and a lot of things that weren't considered. I think a symptom of that, too, is with games being so iterative and not upfront having a full script or a complete idea. Sometimes people are working in isolation. Sometimes there's the desire to, like, make my thing the coolest thing. This is the thing I have to own, so I'm going to make it the coolest thing. But you're working on, like, a tertiary character and they walk in and they're like, more like bombastic than the main character. And you're like, who's that? I'm sorry, what? So yeah, I think all those things, superficial design choices lead to ripping you out of an immersive experience and really allowing a character to feel lifelike and fleshed out and
yeah. Absolutely.
In that same interview.
I don't even know what interview.
You also said that knowing how to navigate creative disagreements successfully is a very valuable skill set to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Want to talk which about I would agree. First, I can definitely touch on it.
I feel that so desperately and intensely. I think something you don't realize coming into the industry, especially if you come in young, is how important soft skills are to these jobs. I was such a little firebrand when I started at Microsoft, where I was just like, I'm great. I know exactly what I'm doing. My art directors are idiots. And I'd wear this on my sleeve and I would get combative. And often I would just get frustrated. And what you realize over time is that so much of this job, especially in directorial positions and lead positions, so much of it is communication up and down the pipeline, communicating with your team, communicating your intent to writers, to modelers, and being able to work through conflicts, because as you said, it's a collaborative process. It's a bunch of people sitting in a room trying to make the best game they possibly can. Everyone has the best of intentions. And when tempers flare, being able to navigate that, and very often the skill to get what you want without the other person realizing that you are getting what you want is a very powerful one. And so by the time I left Microsoft, I was very good this all sounds so Microsoft-y to say, but like presenting solutions instead of problems. But if you go to someone and you just say, I hate this, this sucks, we need to do better, then someone's going to immediately bounce off of that. Mm-hmm. And if you come to it and you're like, I see what you were trying to do, here's another solution I've thought of that might approach it from this direction. And usually you can like weasel your way into someone agreeing with you just because they aren't immediately turning into a brick wall that you're talking against. And then once I became a production designer at HBO and I was dealing with artists, and suddenly I was just like, oh God, being on the other side of it and seeing someone just be like, this sucks, we need to do better. And I'm just like, I know it does, but come on, meet me halfway. So yeah, learning to navigate those situations and learning how to keep things from escalating while still not like backing down, sticking to your guns, choosing the hills to die on. Cause there have definitely been times where I'm like, this is it. This is the one that's super important for me.
Yeah. I would say it's taken me years to really put that into practice and go, I only have so much energy. The person or people I'm working with only have so much energy for me. You know, I need to really evaluate what's important here. What are the hills I'm willing to die on? And what stuff am I willing to just kind of let go and focus on? But yeah, I mean, it's an environment of creatives. Creatives are arguably sensitive and there's a lot of ego, and just being able to diffuse ego, diffuse conflict, those skills are just as important as being able to not be a contributing problem in any of that, making sure that you're being part of the solution. You're not just somebody that's coming constantly with problems. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you're offering solutions. They may not be the best one, but at least it shows that you're willing to help explore and get to the end result, a better end result, hopefully. But that's just something that I wish more people, it's not even young people, there's like, yeah, just like grown ass humans, ass
adults.
Like, what? Where did you? I can't with you.
Storm out of a meeting. I was just like, I would never. I would never be able to do that. And then you watch someone,
yeah,
just storm out and like metaphorically flip a table.
Sorry, like, okay, you are an adult.
Like, calm down.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like the ego and the temper and stuff can flare. But I think we need to expect more from each other and recognize that we're all humans, and it is a creative environment. So there's a lot of subjectivity, and I feel like, yeah, that also leads to a lot of conflict and misunderstanding and miscommunication. And but we need to learn how to use our words and express our feelings in healthy ways, and understand that we're all coming at it with the desire to make something better. But I mean, that really is a skill set that's so important, and not many artists or other creative types put an emphasis on.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wish it were. Like,
it's hard to learn how to do it well.
You're right.
It's there's a class you can take.
Unfortunately, the best way to learn is to be thrown into the fire.
Yeah.
which means you stumble a lot in terms of giving and receiving critique, but eventually.
I think part of the learning too comes from just being, you need to be able to challenge your ideas and your thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so, and that is a skill, and you have to kind of work through it. But if you can kind of like go into something, you know, you feel your ego flare up, you feel like the situation intensifying, and being able to go, I need to walk away for a minute. I have to like go over this and let me come back to you. Yeah. And then you go and you stew and you, but you can work through it and say like, what is it about this that is bothering me? And how do I be part of the solution instead of part of the problem in this scenario? And how can I pull my own weight and be responsible for my own actions so that my coworkers don't have to take on my bad day or my bad mood or whatever?
Yeah.
We like talking about mistakes and failures on here because they're often super helpful with improving your skills, and it reminds people that failing is totally okay, and no matter the skill set, everyone still does it. Like, even you two still fail, I assume, occasionally.
Also, the act of getting to a good design is failing until you don't.
Yeah.
Like, the moment you put pen to paper, you're going to draw some ugly shit.
It's crushing.
Oh, I think people think, the longer you're an artist, that like, oh, no, you can just spit something out now. I'm like, oh, yeah, I can draw a Styracosaurus profile really quickly, perfectly. Like, that is my one thing I can spit out. Everything else, like, no, it's still a muscle. It's still lifting weights.
And it's still dependent on the kind of day you're having. I feel like we take this creativity, whether it's writing or drawing or painting, and there's this expectation that it should be on all the time. Whereas if you're an athlete or anything where you need to use your body, you're standing all day, you know, at a grocery store, you know, whatever. If your body isn't working properly, you can't do your job properly. And so this stuff is no different for us. We're still using our brain. Our brain's going to have off days. So no matter how long you've been doing it, you're still going to not feel great some days. You're going to be stuck other days. So I think being gentle with yourself, whether you're a pro or just starting out, is so important. And I mean, I need to do it. I'm not saying I've mastered that, but I'm saying it with the hope that it'll catch on for me.
So what mistakes or failures have you learned the most from?
Well, I've never failed
once. I'm leaving.
Man, that's a tough question. I feel like that's the one I left blank when I was writing notes for this one. I was like, I know I have failed a lot, but...
Is there stuff from a project that you could talk about that you would still change a lot today if you could?
I don't know. I mean,
I feel like I'd do it better.
Yeah.
It's less like, oh, I would change the decisions I made. Like, that was the best I could, could do in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely, like, there's pitches and things that I could do differently now based off of more experience and more failures along the way. And failing's so important. I was talking to my boyfriend this morning. He was getting upset because he's learning how to make lattes and like latte art and stuff. You know, it's like his little style. He's a sound designer, so he does that all day. And then he has this like little thing to kind of this little hobby. But this morning he was so frustrated. He's like, I keep messing up. I keep failing. I can't make it work. It seems like such a silly thing. But I was like, well, look, like you're learning. Like failing's part of it. Yeah. You can't learn what to do right if you don't learn what to do wrong. So failing is so essential in succeeding. And it happens more often than not. And we just need to, you know, accept it as part of the process and not, it doesn't say anything about you,
yeah,
you know, as an artist or a creator or anything. If you make mistakes or you fail, you're just human.
I feel like a big thing with In the Valley of Gods, when we were still figuring out the style and what it was going to look like in general, was I have like my work brain and my personal brain. My personal art is much more illustrative and stylized than my video game art, because when I was at Microsoft and HBO, I was working on a variety of projects in a variety of styles, but a lot of them are relatively photorealistic. And so my work brain was like, just draw things how they look. That's what we're going to do. So we started working on In the Valley of Gods, and I was churning out these concepts that I just was not happy with. And we're just crossing this line into just super realistic, kind of boring concepts that didn't have anything to say. And instead of taking a step back, I was just brute forcing my way into this problem and staying up late. The Campo team was not asking me to do this. It was fully just like self-imposed of I need to brute force my way through this problem instead of getting some perspective. And Jake and Sean took me out for lunch when I was in town once, and they were like, what's going on? What's happening? I don't think this art is good. You need to take a step back. And it was super nice. I just stepped back. I did a bunch of studies from films I loved. I did a bunch of Lawrence of Arabia studies and then studies from animated films, just to kind of like break my brain and work on something that I wasn't thinking about. And it was enough to kind of to shake me and bring me back to a place where what I was coming up with was like infinitely better than what I would have come up with without going through that struggle. And now that's something constantly in the back of my brain where I'm like, you're painting this too? It's too realistic. Mm-hmm. Stylize it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that stuff is part of the process. I feel like I need to mention this book that I adore called Art and Fear that I am obsessed with. And I just want to buy for everyone because it costs like $11. It's this short little tome from the 90s or something about dealing with art and fear. And when you're good at something, you get to a point where you're afraid of taking chances. So you just stop making art. And it's extremely freeing to the point that I'll just read it all the time as a way to be like, okay, I'm scared of the blank page. I'm not making any art because I'm convinced it has to be perfect from the get-go.
I want
to
read that.
It's so good. Awesome. I'll buy you.
Oh, yeah. I accept. Yeah, that's awesome.
Our last question. What stories do you respond to in games now, and what do you want from a story?
The most recent story that I really responded to was Horizon Zero Dawn, which I was not expecting. I went into it having just seen the trailers, and I was like, this is weird tribal imagery, and I don't know how I feel about it, and this and this. And then playing through it, it's, I don't want to spoil it, but the fact that it's multiple layered narratives that are extremely character-driven, so it's about these very, it's not, you know, it's about end of the world epic things, but it's so character focused, and that to me is the most compelling. I have lost my patience and tolerance for like, the world's about to end and we have to stop it. I'm much more interested in like, the world's about to end, we're gonna focus on this one character and how they're dealing with it. And I've also, like, I lost my mom a couple years back, and so now I have, like, no tolerance for how death is handled in video games.
Yeah.
Where everyone's like, I'm motivated, this is it, this is my calling, because my wife died. And I'm just like, that's not how grief works. It's complex and messy and funny and weird. And so I feel like my bar has definitely gone up, especially since video games are, like, fully centered around death. Where I'm just like, you better think about this.
It's interesting, yeah, that how much games want to tackle that subject matter. I guess just, you know, it's important to humans and
yeah.
They all experience it. I think for me, a lot of the games that have really rocked me have been indie games. Mm-hmm. One of my absolute favorite games. And I feel like that's rare that you can say that in like a game you've played within the past like 10 years. Usually it's like, oh, my favorite game was Final Fantasy III. Yeah. but Night in the Woods really...
that, absolutely.
I cried and I was just... when I played it, I didn't want to know anything about it. I didn't want to know about the creative team or anything. I just went into it. And the game felt so familiar to me to the point where it became eerie. I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania called Irwin. And all of the people, all of the jokes, everything in it was so familiar to me. And when I finished it, I found out that the team, at least I think that it was a 3-person team, potentially I think two of the creators are from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I was like, oh, okay, this suddenly makes so much sense. But I know people that grew up in LA that played it that felt just as immersed and connected to the story. So I don't think it was just that. But May is so human, even though she's a cat, and she's so complicated.
And Bee is dealing with parental death in a really convincing, thoughtful way.
Amazing, amazing. So good. Greg being this like kind of quirky friend, but he has his own kind of stuff going on, so it allows him to be a kind of fleshed out person as well, even though he's a dog. So what an amazing thing that they were able to take the, it's a very stylized game with animals, and it deals with some of the most complex and dark and real shit I've ever seen anybody in a game do. It just, it really rocked me when I played that game. Journey was another big one for me. The mechanic of playing with another person, and I got to play with the same person the whole way through, whereas in other playthroughs I had multiple people. This person stayed with me the whole time, and I felt so connected to them, and we didn't like friend each other after that. We just went our separate ways, and you know, I don't know who they were, but it was so amazing. You know, Inside, I played a game called Virginia.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I played that.
We hired the VFX guy.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, I loved it. I love just these smaller studios that are really taking chances and doing these very relatable and personal games. That just, I feel so much more connected than I do to a lot of AAA titles that are, you know, just being cranked out constantly. And they're just these big bombastic and crazy stories.
I think that point about truth in storytelling is a huge one. And in design is like when someone's just bringing that specificity to a story. And I had the reaction with Night in the Woods where I was like, oh, I feel this, even though I absolutely did not live this life.
Right.
And it's just because you can tell that the people making it are so passionate about the setting and this world that they've created, and the characters feel specific. And I realized it would be so dumb for me not to bring up how formative Firewatch was for me when I played that. Like, I was looking forward to it ahead of the game, ahead of time. I played it at GDC when they had this huge build out. And then when I finally sat down and played it, it was like a year after my mom had passed, and it's dealing with the complexities of grief and how people respond to it, because Henry's wife, Julia, has Alzheimer's, and he decides to run away to the woods. And you can tell Sean Vanneman, who wrote it, was raised in Cody, Wyoming, and that's where it's set. And so you can definitely feel this specificity and truth to these characters in the story. And I remember coming out of it and being like, man, I was so sure, once Westworld VR ships, I'm going to go to animation. I'm going to move down to LA. I'm going to get a job in feature and finally do that, because I'm tired of games. I played Firewatch. I was like, man, I'd stick around for games if I got to work at a studio like Campo Santo. And then it fucking worked out, which blew my mind. But in the same way with Night in the Woods, in the same way with Virginia and Inside, all these things that feel so specifically, thoughtfully designed, where someone just had a vision and they made it. Mm-hmm. And it's, and even when, like, Firewatch was tailor-made for me, it's comical that I didn't get to direct that game. But playing something like Night in the Woods, where I'm like, oh, this is not specifically for me, but it's so true and so plugged directly into someone's heart and brain that you can really sense it, which is, oh, I love that.
Yeah, that authenticity is there. And I wonder, too, if that's just because the team is so much smaller, and so it doesn't get, you know,
diluted.
Yeah.
I don't think bigger companies have the luxury of doing that. They have other luxuries, but but yeah, I think that these games that are coming out that are telling very specific intimate stories, and they're like these just really thoughtful reflections and meditations on people and loss and kind of just the mundaneness of life. I like when that's explored too. I think that I think Firewatch did that in a sense, and I think that Night in the Woods did that, where you're not doing much, but you know it's compelling because it's real.
It's big for those characters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, it's important to them, and if the writing's good, you buy into it being important to you too.
Man, making mundanity compelling. Same with contemporary costume design. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, that's such a superpower.
Yeah.
It's much more compelling in games than it is in film. And maybe it's just like having that agency and just engaging and interacting with it. But, oh, I love it.
Staying with your parents can still be world-ending stakes for you. But on that note, we're going to end things. And where can people find you on the internet?
At Shumla. Pretty much everywhere. It's a name I chose in 1999 for a Myst forum, and it's stuck with me ever since. Or Claire Hummel. You can just Google me. Buy In the Valley of Gods when it comes out. Who knows when? We work at Valve now, so it's a gamble.
I'm on Twitter as Coyote Hackles, and you can find me on Instagram now, Ace Wadowski Art. The art's important, otherwise you're going to get my, like...
I followed
desert
both.
Pictures.
You have classiest personal Instagram. It blew my mind.
It's true.
Oh, my God. Oh,
thanks, guys.
Very intimidating.
Poor man. Jeez. I'm a mess.
And you can find this podcast at ScriptBlockCast on Twitter.
Our album art was done by Lily Nishida at Lily Nishida on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And our music was done by Tumelo at Tumelo Makes on Twitter.
And leave us a review on iTunes, please. And thank you, too, for coming on again.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you so much for having us.